This is All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. It's 10 minutes of 5 on a Friday, and that means Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch and Becky Gray with the Conservative John Locke Foundation are here to dissect the week in politics. Hey there.
Hey.
Hey, guys.
A chaotic week at UNC Chapel Hill. First, Chancellor Carol Folt announced her resignation effective at the end of the academic year. And the same announcement was an, oh, by the way, that Folt had, quote, authorized the removal of the base and commemorative plaques from the Confederate monument site in McCorkle Place, close quote. In other words, what was left of Silent Sam was coming down. Unsurprisingly, this ticked off the conservative UNC Board of Governors. Overnight Wednesday, the remains of the Confederate monument, which was erected during the Jim Crow era, were removed. Hours after that, the Board of Governors convened and decided that Folt would depart at the end of the month, not in May. Rob, many on the left have been less than thrilled with how the chancellor has handled this controversy. Did she save face with you in this final chapter?
I think it was a very admirable act on her part in the end. I thought she found her inner conscience and did the right thing. She realized that her ultimate responsibility is to protect the safety and the of the students and to avoid any violence on campus, and that was the only way that that was going to happen. It's clear that Silent Sam had to go. There was no middle ground. She was in a very difficult position. There was a great essay written this week by the good folks at Higher Education Works, which is a pro-UNC advocacy organization, or at least observing organization. They wrote a great column talking about how she was in a really difficult spot, but that it was a courageous act. She's had a very successful tenure, and let's hope very much that the Board of Governors comes to its senses and doesn't try some sort of absurd backlash, because they've already done enough damage.
Becky, realistically, is there another way that Folt could or should have handled this?
I don't know. I agree with Rob. I think she's been in a very difficult position. And, of course, there's that 2015 state law that says no monuments can be removed without approval of the General Assembly. And so one of her, not excuses, but one of the things that she was bound by through this controversy was that state law. I don't know, and it doesn't really matter now, to be honest with you, at this point. I mean, you know, what she did is what she did. She felt strongly about it, obviously. I mean, I got to hand it to her. She put that play into place pretty well. I mean, within hours of her announcing her resignation, the pedestal was coming down. I think the question now is, where does that leave us, and where are we going to go? Now, in light of this, and again, it's been a very chaotic week, but the Board of Governors has said that the deadline that they had set for a new plan remains at March 15th, that there will be this committee that was formed from the Board of Governors, trustees at the university, and some kind of leadership. I'm not sure who that's going to be. I mean, they're going to need to appoint somebody to fill in for Carol Fall pretty quickly. But that goes forward. So I think it's not so, Jeff, I think the question is not so much what coulda, shoulda have happened. That's in the past. It's done. But where do we go from here? And I think that's the big question.
Sure. And perhaps you and I are on the same page. I think that perhaps it's an instructive question, because whoever comes in next is potentially going to have to deal with either still the issue itself or the remnants of it. I mean, from your position, yes, I realize there's the next wave of proposals and what might happen here. What would you like to see happen with this now removed base and what's a mangled Confederate monument?
I'd like to see some consensus and to move forward and come to some kind of agreement. I'd like to see something that honors our history, but at the same time gives an explanation and presents a learning opportunity, and of course in a safe and secure environment. You know, what I'm hoping for is some sort of consensus so that we can move forward. You know, to be honest with you, I think that UNC Chapel Hill is one of the best universities in the country, and
sure,
I would like to see them, and I think everybody involved in this would like to see them get back to their role of providing the best education in the state of North Carolina.
But unfortunately, I just will add that I think that I agree with that. But unfortunately, I think this series of events that we've had under the present Board of Governors leadership has cast a dark shadow over the University of North Carolina. It's made us a national laughingstock. I think it's going to be very difficult to attract the kind of quality faculty, the kind of quality administrative leadership that we need in this university. And I wish and hope very fervently that the board will go back to doing what boards of governors should do and stop trying to micromanage chancellors on issues like this.
But one way to look at this is an opportunity to start afresh and start over and make it right. And I hope that's the direction that we go in.
Not picking on either of you. Neither of you is qualified for that job, I don't think. But were you in a position where you were offered to be chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill? Would you want that job right now?
I'm not confident enough in my leadership skills, to be honest with you. And I think that, you know, that's the question. I mean, what kind of leader are we going to need to move forward? And, you know, will that be a North Carolinian? Will that be someone from, you know, the ranks across the country? Again, you know, there are huge challenges here. And the Board of Governors really and the Board of Trustees at the University of North Carolina has a big responsibility to move this forward. And then, of course, Bill Roper coming in, again, kind of a fresh start. Mm-hmm. As the new president of the system, lots of opportunities, lots of challenges. I don't feel qualified for it, and I believe that the university system and the university at Chapel Hill deserves the best leadership in the country.
I just think it's akin to being asked to going to work for the Trump administration. Does your duty to your country override your unease at the fact that you're working for incompetent, delusional people? And that's what I think the Board of Governors is. I think that's what Donald Trump is. You can make an argument that it's, you know, that it would be doing your civic duty or your duty to society to serve in such a position. But it's hard to imagine that any person with any real principles could do that very easily unless they had some sort of agreement with this board they're going to back off.
All right, let's move on. State Superintendent Mark Johnson announced plans to reduce the number of standardized tests students must take. He pointed in part to a parent survey in which 78% of respondents said that their children face too many tests. The changes to these standardized tests would include the reduction of the tests themselves, the length of the tests, the number of questions, and he's also seeking to eliminate tests that are not required federally. Good approach, Becky?
I think it's a great approach, and I think this is great news. I tell you, the one thing that surprises me in your introduction, Jeff, is that only 78% of parents surveyed said there's too many tests. Yeah, and the other thing, part of this plan, too, as you mentioned, making the test shorter with fewer questions. I mean, still getting the information that you need, but making the test shorter. The federal thing, as you mentioned, and then also easing the rules for requiring exam proctors, which has, I think, created a lot of stress for teachers and just administratively has been hard to do. I think this is a great first step. I think, in my view, we need to go even further to look at how we can test our kids appropriately so that we're able to measure what they're doing, but also not make education all about the test.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think, though, that we've had this binge of testing madness over the last couple of decades, and it's been driven by this notion that we can sort of extract performance out of students by bludgeoning them with the fear of test results rather than nurturing them and actually investing the resources that they need. Great. I'm glad we're moving away from them. But at the heart of the problem is not so much just having tests. It's the high-stakes test. It's the test, like Senator Berger's Redo Achieve program, which is so far the statistics show has been sort of a miserable failure, that we're going to, you know, not advance kids in lower grades unless they pass high-stakes tests. So, yes, let's reduce the test, but let's get away from this whole notion of high-stakes testing and move to investing resources in our schools so that our kids can actually be nurtured and perform and advance.
And just a quick note, too, kudos to Superintendent Johnson for surveying parents, asking them what they need, what their concerns are, and then being responsive to it. So I think this is a great direction for where we're going in education. Certainly have a lot more work to do, but I think it's very encouraging.
Can I just say, though, that we've also got to move away from this A through F testing of our schools themselves, which is also a function of the testing. That's another program that hasn't worked. It's providing information that's not useful. All it does is measure poverty in our schools. That would be another big test, another big grade to do away with.
It's day 28 of the partial government shutdown, indeed the longest in our history. Opinion polls say a majority of Americans do not support a wall and do put this shutdown on the shoulders of our president. Becky, we're in a moment of what feels like very little compromise, and it seems as though one side is going to have to offer a considerable olive branch to end this thing. You got any optimism?
I always have optimism.
I know.
always have optimism. Yes.
And if so, where is it?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, there is a group, I think, of moderate members of the Congress, both in the House and in the Senate, to try to move this thing forward. You know, a lot of the news reports have indicated, you know, this is all Trump's fault. I just, you know, there are two parties here, and there's two ways to compromise, and there's two ways to move forward with this. And I think both of them, both sides are at fault, and I think that they need to find some sort of compromise on this. National security, border security, I think everybody agrees. Everybody has gone on record over the years of this is a concern and we need to do something about it, whether it's a wall or whether it's something else. It seems to me that there's got to be some sort of policy agreements that they can come to on this. And again, I'm the eternal optimist and believe that eventually we'll get there.
I sure hope so. I mean, everybody agrees we need border security. There's been no debate about that. What's driving this is Donald Trump. He wants his wall. He's ignoring, like, common sense facts, like the fact that there's a river that runs down the border of the United States and Mexico in which a wall would be washed away, in which we already have treaties barring us from building walls in the middle of the doggone Rio Grande River. I mean, it's just craziness. It's Donald Trump at his worst. And the negative effects of the shutdown are really starting to hurt average people. We're seeing evictions. We're seeing people starting to contemplate doing without food assistance, without housing assistance, lots of people going without pay. I mean, it's a bad and just totally unnecessary situation. We could have the debate over this wall anytime, but it's Donald Trump who's forcing us to have it and holding up the government in these however many it is, 9 federal agencies, in order to throw his little tantrum and get his wall.
If he doesn't get the wall, he loses the base, right? I mean, that's ultimately what this is about. If a wall does not go up, he loses his Republican base, does he not? This was the big campaign promise.
It was a big campaign promise. And, you know, he is, I think what his intent is to make good on those campaign promises. Also, this has been an issue for many presidents who have not been able to get anything done. And it's just, he made the promise that he was going to get something done on this. Jeff, I don't know whether he loses the base. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I've been surprised at the polling and that the base that stays with him, it seems like, no matter what he does. So, And it's given him a lot of confidence, I think, to go out and really pursue something.
Sure.
It has emboldened him. So I don't know whether I've been surprised in the past. There have been things that he's done that I've thought, that's it for him. You know, his numbers are going to take a nosedive, and they go up. So I can't explain it.
Right. He's the one who says he could rob a bank or whatever. I mean,
I believe the quote was shoot someone on Fifth Avenue.
Yeah,
I mean, robbing a bank is kind of a step down.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Murdering someone.
Every day. Yeah, it's stunning. I agree with Becky. There have been many instances in which I would have thought, oh my God, this is just so unpresidential, so unacceptable for the leader of the most important nation in the free world to behave this way. But he continues to get away with it. I guess he'll keep trying. But I think at some point, I can imagine a scenario in which he has to surrender, and yet he's still going to be the Republican nominee in 2020.
Finally, a tax story that caught my eye this week. You might answer with a yes or no, or you might say, we're not going to chat about this, and it's totally in your camp, and this will just live on the interwebs. From the News and Observer, North Carolina's Revenue Collection Agency is fighting to defend a state tax on out-of-state trusts whose beneficiaries live in the state, saying it keeps wealthy people with large trust funds from avoiding state income taxes. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to review a ruling that found the tax unconstitutional. This issue has come to 9 state Supreme Courts, and it's split right now, 5-4, which is leading to this review by the High Court, which at least started in earnest today, Friday. Reportedly, this amounts to hundreds of millions of dollars in lost tax revenue in North Carolina annually. It just struck me as something that was interesting. So yes or no, and if you want to expound, please do. Should this loophole be closed? You're looking at me like I'm nuts.
Don't know a lot about this. You know, should tax loopholes be closed? Absolutely. And if this is one, then yeah, I think it does. I don't know enough about it, Jeff, really, to be honest with you. I do think it's interesting that in North Carolina, and other states are looking at this as well, but in North Carolina, the Supreme Court, our Court of Appeals, and our state Supreme Court have all voted against the state. So this goes to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Couple things that are worth pointing out. I think that if you had a Supreme Court made up of low-income people who didn't have any likelihood of ever living off of a trust fund or having
sure.
a family member who did, there'd probably be a different attitude. I mean, let's be honest about this stuff. The reality is that wealthy people have seen their taxes cut repeatedly. They have a way of seeing things in a prism that says, yeah, that's unfair that I'm paying a tax here and I'm paying a tax. This is about income. People living in North Carolina receive. And that's what income taxes are about. It's about taxing your income. So it sounds to me, at least from a superficial examination of the story, that it's entirely plausible that we ought to be taxing it, and that we know for a fact right now already in North Carolina that the wealthiest 1% pays a much lower percent of their income in state and local taxes combined than people in the middle and the bottom. And this would be one small step to add a minor degree of fairness to that.
I would just bring it back to, you know, what they're looking at is the rule of law. And Supreme Court justices and members that are on the Court of Appeals do not determine cases or tax decisions based on their personal income or their experience. They're looking at the law, and that's what these jurists are doing. I think it's insulting to suggest anything else. You know, as this goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, I think we should keep an eye on it. We should see what does, because obviously there's a lot of interest across the country, and North Carolina is not the only state that is taxing it this way.
Of course, I would never insinuate that the justices are making these decisions based upon selfish personal interest. I would only say, however, that when you are a wealthy person, you bring a different set of eyes to looking at issues than do people who are not wealthy. And when you're talking about things like trust funds and taxes on trust funds, things that the vast majority of Americans can't even imagine being a part of their lives, I'm just saying that I believe that there will be a different approach that many people would bring to that if you in fact had a jury or a group of jurists for whom that was not a part of their lives, something they had never experienced. I think you might have a slightly different result.
That's why we have laws written into the book, so that it's not what you want it to be, it's what the law says that it is. And if there are laws that need to be changed, and particularly based on whatever this U.S. Supreme Court decision may be, and North Carolina laws are going to have to be rewritten so that judges throughout our system have the guidance that they need, then that's what we need to do.
But of course, the reason we want diversity on the bench is because we know different judges bring different experiences to the bench. That's the only point I'm trying to make here.
He hadn't used the word diversity yet. I was going to offer this middle ground, but then Rob used the word diversity. Would you agree that there is not a lot of economic diversity on the U.S. Supreme Court? Or is that a misnomer to this conversation from your perspective?
Probably not a lot of economic, because the qualifications that we expect from Supreme Court justices require a deep education background and experience, and that usually comes with, you know, whether you were born with the end of that kind of privilege or whether you earned it through educational opportunities and other things that you did, a lot of hard work and those kind of things. So probably so, but I think it's part of the system that we have, and I don't know what the answer to that would be, to be honest, because we want people on the Supreme Court who have the experience and the knowledge and the training and the education and, you know, the deep things that come with that in order to grapple with these very serious decisions that affect our lives every day.
And you thought we wouldn't have anything to say about that.
Throwaway question. Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield directs NC Policy Watch. Thanks for the conversation.
As always, thanks, Jeff.